Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Mark, let me ask you something. Why are you so wise and you're fucking young? This is bullshit, man. Like, what the fuck? You're like a, like, I feel like when I read your stuff, I'm like, this guy's in his 60s. He's like, what the fuck is going on with you? I mean, it's crazy to me. I don't understand how you accumulated all this wisdom. And you're, I mean, some of this stuff is like that you wrote 10 years ago.
Well, you know, I think wisdom is accumulated via fuck ups. And, and I got a pretty good head start on fucking up. So, yeah. You know, maybe that's what happened.
It's really kind of, it's like, it blew me away. Like, and you know, I, like a lot of people, learned about you from The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck, which became a worldwide phenomenon and still does crazy numbers. I'm sure that experience in and of itself is insane to you, or maybe, I don't know, maybe not. But you know, in reading that, you're like, oh, this is like, it really was like the way you were able to communicate like almost simple things, but in a way that's easier to digest. And you find yourself nodding along, like when you typically are speaking to somebody that's older than you and wiser than you and giving you kind of a life lesson, you know?
Yeah. And yeah. I mean,
I don't know how you did that.
I don't really know either, but like the way I've always thought about it is like all of these, I mean, self-help in general, right? Like there's not none of these ideas are really new. Like it's, the same shit that's been passed down through religion and philosophy for thousands of years. Like really what effective self-help is it's finding ways to remind us of things we already know, in new ways that stick.
Yes.
And so I've just always seen my job, you know, not as like coming up with stuff, but it's like just taking these like important truths that we all kind of know already, but you know, forget when we're scrolling through Instagram for hours on end and like finding a way to like make them stick into people's brain.
That's a really interesting way of putting it. I feel like that, did you ever read the Four Agreements, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I remember the first time I read that, I was like so blown away. And then somebody asked me about it and they were like, so like, what are they? And it was like, be truthful with your words and like things that you already know. And you go, well, I don't know why it's leaving such an impact. And it's the way that it's being delivered to you. Like it's repackaging it in a way, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that book is beautiful in its simplicity. Like, I think there's something very pleasing about taking like very, like, you know, something like be impeccable with your word, like be honest, essentially. Like that's, it sounds simple, but it's like so complicated in the course of your life. Like you end up in all these situations where it's very ambiguous what honesty is or whether you should be honest or not. And you know, and so a brilliance of a book like that is just able to like take those complicated situations and make them feel simple. And you know, and like, I think that's where the value is. It's funny too, cause you know, in this industry, you know, the writer or the thinker generally gets all the credit. Like it's, you know, you've got the whole guru model and, you know, people who get paid tens of thousands of dollars to stand on stage and talk. And it's like, we're actually just like repackagers. Like it's not, nobody's actually coming up with anything. It's just like really, really thoughtful and kind of brilliant, you know, it's like Apple, right? It's like Apple didn't invent any of the shit that they made. They just like packaged it better and made it better. And like that's what good self-help is, essentially.
It's doing it with ideas and like and how to apply them. Yeah. Totally. I mean, I think part of, obviously, like, the brilliance of what you did is taking the ideas and the way you, I mean, it was written, it was described this way too, that it was like the self-help for the people that are like, I don't want to read that shit. Yeah. But part of it is, you know, the way you write, the language you speak, I feel like I'm reading, like a buddy typing me an email or something, you know, whereas yeah. every time I've read anything from self-help before, it just, there's like a distance, like a separation where you go, this is, I don't know, more like a professor or somebody giving a lecture, and totally. And your stuff feels much more personal because of just the way you write.
Yeah. It's funny, when my last book came out, it was reviewed in the Sunday Times in the UK, and it was reviewed by this like old, stodgy, like 80-year-old dude. And of course he hated it. He thought it was trash. Mm-hmm. And he, but in the course of the review, he described me, he said, Manson is like the local town drunk who spent too much time in the philosophy section. And like, I saw that, I'm like, wow, that's actually one of the best compliments.
That's awesome. That's
I'm like, that's awesome description. That's exactly what I'm going for. Like, I'm the guy in the bar who has had a few, but you know, has read a bunch of stuff. And
that is, that was everything is fucked that he,
he said that. About, yeah. yeah.
Now you strike me as you did, obviously, for all the stuff you've written, it feels like you've consumed a lot, right? I mean, like, in other words, read a lot and yeah. digested a bunch of information, whether it's philosophy, psychology. So did you have that where you can like really big on that in your youth too?
Yeah, I've always been a bookworm. I didn't always do great in school. You know, I was that kid in class who like was reading a book, but it was like a book that had nothing to do with the class, you know, like sitting in the back, like reading like a, you know, Marilyn Manson biography or something. So I've always been like very autodidactic and just read constantly, but I was also, that didn't translate to like academic success all the time.
Sure. I got to tell you something, man. So in getting ready for this, you know, I had not heard of, and I discovered models.
Yeah.
And I'm so fucking fascinated, like fascinated by it in so many ways, like in so many layers. This was your first book, and I just want to make sure I read. It's Models Attract Women Through Honesty, right?
Yep. Yep.
And I was like, oh, this is like interesting. So I started reading it, and so many things hit me. Number one was how I so wish that when I was 15, 16, 17, that I had this book to read it, and how I feel like it would have changed my life. and also at 18 and 19 and 20 and 21 and 22. And then some of the lessons that because I started reading it just absolutely captivated by it. I go like, oh, I learned, I feel like I figured out this at 36 or something, you know, or it really, and also the fact that still one of my favorite things to do is have a conversation with a guy who's single or going on a date and just hear his dating stories and hear the psychology, hear his approach, hear what happened. It's endlessly fascinating to me, attraction, dating. Mm. I mean, I'll watch a dating show, especially like the more realistic it is, like a reality show, but not where it's like, you know, just to watch people like yell and scream at each other, but to see somebody go on. I love that world. And I feel like you in this book break down something that is, again, you know, I don't know why we ignored it for years, which was, part of it was just cultural, that we were raised, or men were raised, to be like stoic or macho or, you know, flashy, like all that generation. And now things have evolved into, no, be vulnerable and try to connect. How in the fuck did you get to writing this? And you wrote that, what, 10 plus years ago?
Yeah, 2011.
Dude.
I mean, so it's, I definitely, So I have a weird history with that world. Like, so I was that guy, you know, the whole pickup artist thing happened back in what, the mid 2000s or whatever. Yeah. And I was in high school and college when all that was going on. And so I kind of like fell into that little world. And, you know, cause I was the dweeby guy who couldn't get a girl to like me and all that stuff. And so I started reading a lot of those books and digesting it and trying it out. And it was funny because it, some of it, you know, quote unquote worked, you know, it was like, it would get me a date or get me laid or whatever, but it just felt awful. Like it felt very, I felt like a car salesman. And it took me a long time to kind of like put my finger on like why it felt awful. And it was just, it's like most men's dating advice and a lot of women's, but not all women's, but most like 99% of men's dating advice up until about 10 years ago was very like status obsessed. It was all about like, you know, all right, you want to be the dude with a Ferrari and like the champagne bottles at the club, but you're broke. So here are like 8 things you can do to make girls think you're the guy with the Ferrari in the bottles at the club. And it's like that is so pathetic on like so many levels. Like it's just very dehumanizing to, right,
that's,
to
that advice is like, here's how you can deceive people and get them to, you can manipulate them through these series of lies.
Yeah. Like, so that's the advice. It's essentially, you know, it's setting you up for failure because it's essentially just teaching toxic manipulation to people. It's also dehumanizing for the man himself because it's kind of reinforcing this bad belief that like a man is only worth like how much money he has or how many girls he sleeps with. It's bad for the women because it you know, encourages men to continue to objectify women and treat them as, you know, trophies and objects and stuff. So it was just, it's a mess all the way around. And so I, it was funny because I kind of, you know, dipped my toe into that world and was very dissatisfied with it. And I just became fascinated with like, why is this so dissatisfied? Like why, you know, I was like 22 and I'm like, well, I'm actually getting laid now, but I'm less happy than I was when I was like the dorky guy who couldn't get a date. You know, I just feel like it's because all the relationships I had were so dysfunctional and so toxic. And so,
but I think one of the things about you though, is just at 22 recognizing that, I feel like most people, myself included, would have just been like, well, I mean, I'll just keep doing this. Like, even if it doesn't feel good.
Yeah. Well, and what I noticed too is that like the other guys in that world felt the same way, but they just blame the women. They're like, oh, well, it's, you know, women, like women are like, they're crazy and they're selfish and they'll use you for things and stuff. And so it became like super sexist and that didn't feel very good either. So I just kind of like started probing like why, you know, where is the dysfunction in this? And by that time I had started my blog and I was writing a lot about dating relationships and I was getting emails from a lot of guys around the world with their situations and stuff. And I just slowly started kind of piecing together like what a healthy relationship is. And, you know, there is a lot of advice out there that's kind of directed towards women about what a healthy relationship is, but nobody, you know, when you go to a, like your random dude in 2010, you're like, Hey bro, you gotta be more vulnerable. Like the guy's gonna laugh in your face. Like he's gonna think you're a joke. And so I kind of took it on myself as a challenge to how can I write this stuff in a way that like doesn't emasculate the male reader, like that it shows a guy like you can be a emotionally healthy individual and respect yourself and respect women, but still be a dude. Like you don't have to like be a wishy-washy, you know, you don't have to like cry during Pixar movies to like,
was that a challenge though? Was that a challenge to be able to communicate that idea?
It was. And it's funny because, you know, I kind of wrote models when I was writing it. I was like, I'm very confident that like, this is the way to be like a good person. And this is what this industry needs. But I'm done with these people. Like, I can't do this anymore. And so I'm going to write this book. I'm going to put it out there. And if it changes the narrative or changes the discussion, then great. Or I'm just going to be laughed out of the room and fuck it, whatever. That's fine too.
Yeah.
And initially I was laughed at quite a bit. Like, a lot of people in that world thought it was a joke. They're like, can you believe this guy? He's telling people to be sissies and be vulnerable and be like, yeah, open up their emotions and stuff. And it took a couple of years to catch on. But I'd say by like 2013, 2014, it was the best-selling men's dating book on Amazon. And I think it pretty much has been ever since.
That's crazy. It made sense that I, you know, wasn't aware of it when it came out, because I wasn't dating. But I mean, I just started to read that and I was like, oh man, I was just thinking back to like how insecure and lost I was, you know, like in dating. I didn't know what the fuck I was doing. And I was, you know, kind of an introvert and just, yeah, just totally insecure. And then you run into like that dating advice that they were like, you got to insult them, kind of be like, yeah, what's up with your fucking teeth? And then she'll like you. And you're like, oh, that's real cool. And then people be like, yeah, that works. I'm like, yeah, I can't do that, man. I don't know how to do that. That's not for me.
Doesn't feel right.
What you wrote was like, oh, it feels like things that, again, like as I've gotten older, you're like, yeah, that's just, you mean be a person, treat them like people, show, you know, like be it. I love everything about also, because you look back on it when you were like, you go like, what was so undesirable about me? And you're like, oh, it was all my neediness. Like, yeah, I was just like this needy mess.
Yes.
Without totally even recognizing it, you know?
Yeah, totally. And it's, you know, part of my inspiration when I wrote that was very similar. I wrote it when I was 27 and I'd kind of gone through this whole journey and been through all these disastrous relationships. And so I kind of looked at myself and I was like, okay, what do I wish 18-year-old Mark? Like, write the book that I wish 18-year-old Mark picked up and read instead of like The Game, you know?
Yeah, The Game.
And so that's what I went for. And, I'm still very proud of it. You know, and my favorite thing about that book, and it's funny because I remember I blogged this back then. I remember I wrote this blog post back in like 2009, 2010. And I said, there's still not been a true men's dating advice book, because as soon as one exists, you'll know that a true men's dating advice book exists because women will be buying it and giving it to the men in their lives.
Yeah.
And back then it was very much like men's dating advice was like, oh no, you have to hide this. Like, you can't let, like, if a girl comes over, you have to like put this like in the closet so that she doesn't know you have it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's a red flag, man. Like, if you're like that kind of tells you a lot right there. Cause it's like, if you had really, really good men's advice, women would be the biggest fans of it. And so when eventually models started landing on the radar of a lot of women, and I started getting emails from women saying, I bought this for my brother, I bought this for my son, I bought this for my, you know, my dad just got divorced and I got it for him. And to me, that was the most validating thing, is like, that's how you know it's correct, is that the women are like dying for men to read this.
Well, and I think, you know, it's one of those things that I'm sure still would obviously hold up now. And the reason being is that there's so many dudes that need help, that are lost, that don't know, you know, I mean, oddly enough, I find myself, you know, we have podcasts and predominantly male viewers and listeners, and they ask all the time, they ask for dating advice. It's still a thing that, like, it's one of those universal things that, like, I think that's why I always stay interested in it. It's like being interested in you know, like how people communicate. It's like, it's never not interesting to me.
Well, what's fascinating too, is that, I mean, it doesn't surprise me, right? Like, it's one of the most fundamental human drives is a romantic relationship. And, but what's interesting to me is that, you know, for, for generations now, it's been socially acceptable for women to kind of express confusion or frustration or doubt or ask for help. But it has never been socially acceptable for men to do that. And I feel like it's just now starting to be socially acceptable. Like it's you're seeing it more and more. Like it's not this like underground thing that we have to like find like internet chat rooms that yeah. nobody knows about. But it you know, it's like that desire is always there. Like it's men are just as confused and frustrated and you know, compelled to have a relationship as women.
Oh yeah. And a big part of it, it's just, it is the, that our youth, you know, young people today are not tied and married to those ideas that like our fathers' generations were, which is like, yeah. you don't go to therapy unless you're crazy as fuck. And you know, you don't, yeah. Why would you cry? And like, you just, you know, like you basically put on an act around women. Like it's all these, it's things that they were raised believing. You know, yeah. but now, you know, young people go like, oh no, like they roll their eyes at those ideas, thankfully. And I think, yeah. you know, in another generation, it'll be something we don't even recognize.
Yeah, for sure.
When you had this success of that, you know, I think the natural thing for most writers would be like, oh, I should do a follow-up just like in the same lane. Right. Like
yeah.
something about relationships only. Like what did you have that temptation to stay in there, or were you being told like, what are you doing? Just write another, you know, relationship thing, like relationship advice.
It's funny. You know, I very much had the opposite. I mean, first of all, there's really only so much relationship advice. Like you,
yeah.
it doesn't really change or evolve. Like there's no innovation happening in the world of human relationships. Like we're pretty much built the same emotionally as for the last, you know, 10,000 years or whatever.
Yeah.
But also I just felt like it was one of those things, like I had been blogging about it for so long, and then models was kind of the culmination of all that blogging and thought. I was just so done with the topic. Like I just yeah. like, I was very much like, I don't have much else to say. Like it's all here. Like, go read it's that. Here. Like, it, yeah. you know, it's, it was also weird back then. Cause it's, you know, being a self-published book, you don't get that same. So for instance, when Subtle Art took off and became a massive hit, instantly the publisher began putting pressure on me, like, to essentially write a Subtle Art part two. And, mm-hmm. And I had to resist that a lot and kind of fight for Everything Is Fucked to be a different book and a different style and have different types of ideas. You know, when you self-publish something and it takes a couple of years to take off, like you don't get that same feedback loop. You don't get, you know, there's not an editor calling you up and offering you a bunch of money to like write Models 2.0.
Right.
So it was I was just kind of off in my own little internet bubble, like, you know, playing with new stuff. And I didn't really think about it.
Yeah.
I will say though, I'll just add on to that. I did, a lot of women want me to write a version for women. And I, you know, in a perfect world I would, but I don't have time. Yeah. It takes a long time to write a book.
Yeah. I mean, even though I think I was reading the Models that you were able to crank that out initially really fast, like 3 months.
Yeah, but it was bad. Like, man, I was like, I had no idea what I was doing. Yeah, the first version of Models was terrible. It's still like I basically had like I had dozens of readers emailing me with typos and grammatical mistakes and like
okay,
you know, shit that any even like half decent editor would have caught on a simple revision. So it took about a year of updates to kind of
get it to where it was.
To get it to like a presentable state. Yeah.
How long did it take you to write Subtle? And it's like when you set out to write it,
about a year and a half.
A year and a half.
About a year and a half. Yeah, all my books have been about around a year and a half.
Did you, okay, because like we obviously know how big this became. Did you have any anticipation? I mean, you know, you had the experience of writing a book. You spent your time getting this together. I'm assuming when you're done and it's ready to print, you're happy with it. The publisher is like, you know, happy with it. Do you have any anticipation of like, oh, I hope this does like, okay, I hope this makes it onto a bestseller list. Like anything?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, my goal when I published it was to hit the New York Times list. That was kind of like, yeah, you know, the big goal. And it debuted on the Times list, which I was happy. And so anything from there was kind of bonus. You know, it's funny in hindsight. So to kind of give a little bit of context, my blog really blew up in 2013. It started, I had a number of super viral articles, and by like 2014, I was getting 1 to 2 million readers each month.
Wow.
And I knew which articles worked. Like I knew which ideas were just like spreading like crazy. So in hindsight, it's like, I shouldn't have been that surprised. I think at the time, yeah, I think at the time, you know, cause it was market tested. Like it was,
right,
you know, we had seen that these ideas resonated with people and the way I wrote resonated mm-hmm. with people. But like, it's funny cause at the time, I think just publishing was such a new world that I was so unfamiliar with. And I think also just kind of being the scrappy upstart blogger, like, you know, it's like the New York Times list was still kind of this like holy grail, a very unattainable thing. I didn't put two and two together. Like I didn't realize that the millions of people reading and sharing on Facebook would translate to millions of people buying in bookstores. But yeah, in hindsight, it makes sense.
Like, what is it, even though like in hindsight, I mean, what did it feel like when it was, you know, just like a verifiable hit? Do you remember being like, does that affect you in any other way than just like, that's great?
Well, it's great for a while, and then it fucked with me for a while. So the funny thing about the publishing world, which I think is different than other forms of entertainment, like it's a slow burn, right? So it's like, if you have a hit movie, like you kind of know immediately it's a hit movie and people mm-hmm. start stopping you on the street.
Yeah.
With a book, it takes months for it to kind of build and mm-hmm. the word of mouth to kind of catch on or whatever. So it gradually happened over the course of like 6 or 8 months, and it got to number one and it hit a million sales and it just kept going and going and going. And so there was kind of this extended slow celebration of like, oh my God, it's like doing even better now. But then there was like this inflection point because it reached like such a crazy level of success that it started freaking me out, because I'm like, oh shit, I'm 32 and nothing I ever do again is going to do this well. So it actually became a little bit demoralizing for a while. And the pressure started mounting of like, fuck, how do I follow this up? Like, what do I do now? You know? And I didn't really know how to handle that for a while. Like I think it messed with me for about a year, and I had trouble writing. I lost a lot of confidence in my writing. There's a lot of imposter syndrome going on. Mm-hmm. And it was rough. And the funny thing about this too, is like, I mean, I don't know if you've had a similar experience at any point in your career, but it's like, when it first started happening, like I felt like such a dumbass, because I'm like, literally the best thing that can possibly happen to an author is happening to you.
Yeah.
And like, and you're struggling to get out of bed in the morning, you know, yeah. Like, I'm like, what is wrong with you, Bart? But it's funny how many people I meet, particularly like in the entertainment fields, who have similar kind of experiences of like,
definitely, you know,
their first big success, and they just, it just fucks with them big time.
It fucks with you. It does. I've definitely experienced, similar feelings, particularly after things have gone really, really well, you know, like huge tours and big shows and getting paid. And you're like, oh, wow, this is everything like you dream of. And then, I mean, the imposter syndrome sets in and I go, I'm incapable of writing a joke. I don't know what I'm doing. What, like all those same emotions. And it's funny because I don't know exactly how to explain getting out of it, other than the only thing is like I sharing that helped me, like talking to other particularly comedians about it, and then just being like essentially get like making myself get to work, like actually do work, get on stage, finding and that's the thing about like there's I don't know what it is for like writers necessarily, but in comedy you go, there really is nothing like a new bit, like a new joke, a new, and when you see, like when you're capable, when you find yourself doing something new and it works and that feeling, it's like the greatest feeling. And that cures for me all those other feelings. Like it's the only thing that I know. And then now the thing is that feeling comes back. Like what we're talking about comes back. Like after a special comes out, you get like this crazy global praise for a special and you sit there and you're like, oh, that feels good. And then you get like to the lowest point where you're like, how will I ever come up with a new hour?
Yeah.
But now that feeling is familiar. So in other words, I go, oh, I remember that I felt like this last time and the time before. Yeah. So even though I don't feel good about it, I'm like, I know I can get out of this just because I've done it before.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's it for me.
That makes sense. And it's, ultimately I had to work myself. I had to write myself out of it, essentially.
You did the work.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was funny too, because, you know, initially when I sat down, I was like kind of hypercritical and I was like, well, the fans expect this and my readers want that. And the publisher is saying this and blah, blah, blah. And like what really kind of broke the spell was I was like, okay, wait, fuck everybody. Like, what do I want to see on paper? You know, like what is exciting me at this moment? Like what ideas, what's challenging me artistically? And that kind of got me out of it, but it's a weird thing, man. A friend of mine called it, astronaut syndrome, because, apparently, you know, astronauts, once they go to space, they come back to Earth and they get super depressed. Cause they're like, wow, I'm never going to do anything as interesting and cool as going to space again.
Yeah. that's very interesting. Yeah. I mean, it must feel like that on a whole other level.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's strange to explain that to somebody, because they go like, isn't this great that all this great stuff happened? And you're like, well, yeah, but that's the thing is, I think that people don't think about, even when something is like really well received and celebrated, you still are just a guy and you're like, yeah, but I would like to just keep working. I don't want to just, I'm not going to enjoy that feeling for fucking a year, man. Like it's you know. It's a fun week or whatever, you know, it's like, I'm ready to go. Like it's time to go.
Yeah. It's weird how, you know, I think people like the creator of being the creator of art, you experience your work in a completely different way than everybody else does, you know? And so I think people often project how they experience your work onto you. They like assume that you must be just as thrilled and happy as they are.
Yeah.
Or that happiness is as constant and like persistent as theirs is for you.
Yeah.
Whereas like on the inside, like, man, you're just like, you're doing loop de loops and you're fucking up one day and down the next. And it's hard to explain that to people who like don't live it, but
yeah. And you also like, and like for what I do, you know, like when I'm on tour and you're doing hundreds of shows, you always want that audience. I don't want to tell the audience that I'm not enjoying this or
I'm having an off night today. Like,
I'm trying to figure out this bit and it's just not landing. And I don't like you guys. Like, I can't fucking say that. You always want to be like, that was great. And that was fun. And a lot of times it is, but you know, it is, I mean, look, thankfully actually that it's a ride and it's up and down, because that's what makes it kind of a journey, you know, is that not just this, like this all the time. That wouldn't be, I don't think, that fulfilling creatively if you're just like, yeah, whatever, man. Like, I like that, you know, the fun thing about comedy, at least live comedy, is that you take a risk, and the higher the risk, the higher the, you know, the chance that you could either fail horribly or hit like a fucking grand slam. And you have to, you know, if you're not taking the risk, you'll never get those monster laughs, but also you can fucking bomb.
Yeah, for sure.
It's scary and exciting. I was thinking about like one thing in Subtle that it seems like, again, like so simple, right? It's just like a simple thing that I'm 42 years old right now, and I find myself having gotten much better at it, much better at it. But I still think it's something that I work on to this day, is recognizing, that's not for me and I don't want that. Yeah. But, and now I'll act on it, man. I don't think I really started doing that until I was in my, like, I don't know, late 30s or something, where I finally was like, oh yeah, I don't think I actually want that. I think other people want that, or I think I want that, but now it settles in. It's amazing that you were able to grasp that concept at your age.
Well, the concept's easy, doing it's fucking hard.
I still
struggle with that. I mean, that's the thing about a lot of these concepts too, right? It's like, it's, you know, so what, you know, what you're referencing, I talk about how like the saying no is a skill, like it's a skill you learn and develop throughout your life. But like any skill, like you're never done with it. Like you're never like, you know, nailed it. Don't have to like work, you know, it's like you never have to stop. Like you always have to keep working on it. And it's funny, cause it's something that I continue to work on, and it's been interesting too over the last few years. You know, cause you know, with the breakout success of Subtle Art and everything, like all these very shiny and sexy opportunities come through the pipeline, and things that, you know, I've never been exposed to before, opportunity, you know, and probably once in a lifetime type opportunities. And I just started saying yes to everything. And I've kind of hit that point, like, actually it was with COVID that really showed me, I'm like, wait, I don't actually like doing like 90% of this stuff. Like the thing I like doing is sitting in a room by myself with a Word document. Like that's still the thing that I enjoy the most. So why am I saying yes to all this shit? Like, why am I still like doing all this stuff? So it's weird. It's like weird turning down shiny and sexy things.
And that happens more, like, cause it's happened to me also more, the more successful I've become, the more of those opportunities, some of them are opportunities that you'd heard about, you know, like before you ever had a chance, and you're like, oh my God, if that ever were to come up, you know, and then it comes up and you're like, And I think the fact that you have doubt when that sexy opportunity arrives is a something to listen to. You're like, why am I feeling like immense doubt about this in this moment? You know?
Yeah.
And then, I mean, the reverse of it for me is that if I'm scared of something, I try to investigate why I'm scared. And sometimes like it'll be like, if it's creatively related, like let's say I get invited to do a show and it's like a particular crowd that I know is going to be there, I'm like, I feel like fear. I'll stop and my immediate reaction is like, stay away. But then I go, oh, you know what? The fact that I'm kind of scared to perform at that show is telling me that maybe I should go perform at that show. Like those are the things I try to say yes to. I try to say no if I start thinking about everything involved with what happens if I say yes to this opportunity, and I go like, yeah, but none of it's appealing to me. I don't want to be in that room. I don't want to be on that set. I don't want to be like, I'm not saying no because I'm in fear. I'm saying no because I know I'm not going to enjoy this experience. It's going to take me away from things I enjoy doing.
Yeah. And it's weird too, because I think, you know, when you're young and you're starting out, and I think this is probably true for any career, you know, like you need to say yes to everything. Like you need
you
need to say yes to every opportunity that comes and take a chance on, you know, take every shot you get. But then like paradoxically, like the more successful you get, the more you have to like train yourself to start saying no to more and more things. And it's hard. I remember like, I got invited for like some speaking gig out in Switzerland. And like, I ended up in this room. It was so funny. So one thing that happens to me a lot is a lot of like kind of conventional, what I call like woo-woo self-help people. You know, people who believe in like spirit crystals and that like their chi is controlling the world's, you know, whatever. They're really into my shit and they think I'm one of them. Despite the fact that I explicitly make fun of them like throughout my work they think I'm one of them. And so I found myself at this conference in Europe and I'm sitting in this room and we're like doing like, you know, spirit energy exercises by looking into each other's eyes. And I just remember like thinking to myself, I'm like, I gotta start saying no to more shit. Like, like what the fuck am I doing here, man?
Yeah.
like it was a big eye-opening moment for me. It's like, man, I gotta start turning these things down. Like, what's going on?
Yeah, and then like you feel like, I mean, those you need those, and you get, for me, it was like going on to a show, a set, and I was like, this sucks. It's taking up this much time. I don't want to be here. And even at the end of it, I don't like, it's not like you go, well, it sucks, but it's worth it. It's like, I felt like this sucks and it's not worth it.
Yeah.
I didn't enjoy any part of this. So now, I don't know. It's always in my head now that like when an opportunity arises, really examine whether or not it's going to be something you're going to enjoy doing.
Yeah.
Huge lesson for me. Another thing that you touch on a lot, and I feel like it has grown so much more since you were writing about it, is how many, like, the world is overflowing with entitled people. It is there's another pandemic and it's entitlement. It's like, it's to a point where I don't have the vocabulary to describe it, but it's like we have become a society of entitled people.
Yeah. It's funny. I started writing an article in the middle of the pandemic called The Entitlement Virus. And it was, you know, I was going to use, you know, coronavirus as like a metaphor for, cause it's, I mean, I agree with you. It's, and what's funny is like, I get, so, you know, I write a lot about entitlement and how it seems to be a growing phenomenon in our culture, and we're more exposed to it through social media and everything. And it's so funny because I get emails from people, and I get it from people all walks of life. So old people, young people, people on the right, people on the left, people like, you know, just everybody, religious people, atheists, like, and everybody's like, yeah, Mark, you're totally right. It's all those other fucking people. Yeah, exactly. And they're like, man, if we could just, you know, all these fucking lefties or all these fucking righties, like they're so entitled, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, it should be like this, and we should go back to this era when these things happen. And I'm like, you realize like this email is like perfectly encapsulating what I'm talking about. You know, like there's,
and no, they don't. They don't realize.
No, they don't get it. There's one of my favorite quotes ever is that David Foster Wallace. He said, the thing about evil people is that they think everybody else is evil. And so it's a lot of like what I've been focusing on the last year or two, especially through the pandemic, is just like humility. It's just like trying to like remind people, like, you know, like, you don't know what's going on, man. Like, nobody does. Like, we don't, it's gonna be 5 years before we like figure out what actually the fuck happened here. So like, just chill out for a minute, you know, and like, let there be a little bit of uncertainty, like be willing to sit with a little bit of it. It's been hard. It's been really frustrating.
Do you feel like, cause one other thing that popped really big in the last 5-6 years that I don't recall seeing this level of it in my youth, and that is the level of vitriol people have for one another, for people who don't agree on all of their beliefs. Like when you talk about lefties and righties, I mean, obviously like that's a big one, but people now go like, you know, like I remember I went to, I was in LA when I was living there not long ago, and I got invited to go to a gun range that is outdoors. That's incredible. And it's where a lot of the studios send their actors to prepare for, you know, like for movies, like
action roles. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Keanu Reeves trained there for John Wick, and Michael B. Jordan went there, and Kevin Hart and Halle Berry. But anyways, I got invited to go. It's fucking so fun. Right. Mm-hmm. So I did like a couple of posts about it, like just on Instagram, like here's where I am. It's called Terran Tactical. And it was amazing to me that some people were like their comment was, well, you just lost a fan, or like, didn't know you were like this. I'm like, didn't know I was like, what? Like having fun at a range. Like they interpreted it as pro gun, which, you know, I'll just say, I'm not trying to make a statement by posting this video. It wasn't like a pro gun or anti gun thing. It was like, I'm at this awesome place having this incredible experience. To me, it more like that, those types of comments symbolize to me like the way so many people are today, where they're like, oh, you, that's what you say about this, then I'm putting you in this category. You sit here for me from now on. And I just feel like, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago or something, that it wasn't really, as people just were more like, oh, you like to do that too, or that looks cool. And now it's, people have to know, they have to put you in that label on you if they figure out something about you.
It's like, you know, when you like, you go to Starbucks and like they fuck up your order, and you know, like and you go up and you like bitch and complain, and you're like, I
put
demand like
through the fucking register.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's like people are adopting that attitude for everything in the world. Like, it's like, oh, this comedian I like likes guns. Like, I'm going to I'm going to show him like how wrong he is. You know, it's I think it's kind of a toxic behavior, you know, look, and we've all got a little bit of that in us. Like we're all a little bit like that, but like, I think one, social media kind of enables and rewards it, you know, just because of the nature of how the algorithms work and everything. So I think it's what ends up happening is the people who are the most whiny and entitled end up with the biggest bullhorns. And I actually wrote an article about this a few months back. I talked about how it's like, if you really look at the data of how like the content that's produced online and then what actually gets shared and like kind of the degrees of how much something is shared or viewed, what we're really seeing is like there's a silent majority of mostly reasonable people in the middle. Like it's like, you know, you posted that thing to Instagram or Twitter or whatever, you know, it's probably like 90% of your fans were like, oh, cool.
Yeah.
You know, whatever. Or even like the fans who are like not in the guns. Like I'm not in the guns at all, but if I saw that, I'm like, whatever. Like some people are in the guns, you know? Yeah. But what happens is, first of all, the people who don't care much aren't going to be willing to post something. So you just never hear from them. And then the minority, like the 10% who care enough either way to post something, you know, it's going to be like the whiny, bitchy people who the algorithm rewards, because that's what people engage with. It's really fascinating. When I was doing research for this article, I found people who have researched social media and like how stuff is disseminated. Like they came up with something called the 99-1 rule, which is basically what they found is 1% of people on social media produce 90% of the content. 9% of the people engage with that, with the 1% who are creating 90% of the content, usually agreeing or disagreeing or arguing about it. And then 90% of people just don't fucking care and like never post anything. And so
are the real stats.
Yeah. And it's like, so there's what gets lost and what people don't realize or forget is like, you know, it's easy to go on Twitter and just see like this fucking dumpster fire of a political argument and lose all faith in the planet. But like what you're missing is that there's this massive, silent, invisible audience that's 10 times bigger than the people posting.
Sure.
That agrees with you, that thinks is like, this is stupid. Like what's wrong with these people? You know,
they're just not commenting that. Like, I don't because we were talking about this. We've talked about this endlessly among comedians, right? Because you have jokes that can really.
Oh. And you guys can get fucking hammered for shit.
Oh, yeah.
Like if you say the wrong thing or it's taken out of context, like I'd be, your career can get fucked up.
Well, we've had it happen. I mean, like myself and friends have had it happen many times. And you go like, well, you know, you start reading comments and it's like, well, we started talking to each other. I mean, I remember I had a conversation with one friend and he was like, yeah, but who, he's like, who's writing these comments? And I'm like, well, people. And he's like, yeah, but he goes, do you write comments like on YouTube? And I was like, no. He was like, yeah, of course. We wouldn't even be friends.
Like, yeah. like, you have better things to do. Yeah.
Who do you know writing comments? And I was like, yeah, that's true. And you get, and then you start to go like, if you start to pay attention when something flares up, like over the last year, all these comics have had a thing. It gets the attention and you start going, oh my God, what? And you go, just watch, wait, whatever, a day, a week. Mm-hmm. And it's like a noisy explosion of comments of like that 9%. Yep. And then it's like, most people don't know what you're talking about. Don't care. I've brought up, you know, something that like inflamed audiences to executives and they're like, I have no idea what you're talking about. Like they don't register it. Most people are just like, yeah, I'm not in that 9%.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like what we're starting to realize slowly is that, you know, it's social media is not an accurate reflection of reality. And it's like a funhouse mirror of reality. Like vaguely resembles what is actually happening in reality, but it distorts, it amplifies certain aspects and diminishes other aspects. And I think that's kind of like, you know, one thing that I've written about for a few years now is just advising people to, like, I call it the attention diet, which is basically, you know, the same way you kind of restore your physical health by restricting all the crap that you consume. Mm-hmm. You know, you can restore your mental health by restricting all the crap information you're exposed to. And so, you know, I kind of have this like step-by-step thing of unfollowing lots and lots of people and limiting how often you use your phone and how often, you know, which social media platforms you get on or how long you're on them or whatever. And it's funny because like the most common experience people have when they kind of go through this process of like just relinquishing their social media engagement, is they feel liberated. They're like, you know, because there's kind of this weird irrational fear of like, oh my God, but if I'm not on Twitter every day, then like, I'm going to miss out. Like, I'm not going to know what's going on. And then it's actually the opposite happens. It's like you get off and you're like, wow, the world's fine. And actually like,
yeah,
like there's a lot of better things to do. You know, it's like, you actually go do things, like engage people face to face. So,
Mark, can you please, like, more clearly write this article for all of us to share and have it go with a lot of statistics.
Yeah. I mean, check it out. Attention diet. It's on my website. Check it out.
Attention
It's, I've been like a fucking, you know, like the guy who stands in the park with the Bible screaming at people. Like I'm that with the attention diet the past 2 years is like fucking unfollow like 80% of the people you follow, delete apps off your phone. Like, it's your life.
I had like I would call it like a my like a diet, like the sickness, attention sickness that I had, a cycle where I would go, man, it was so fucked up. I would take my phone and I would go Twitter, scroll, close, Instagram, close, YouTube, close, and then emails, like to see what emails. Then I'd close it and be like, yeah, that's too much of that. And then I would go, well, what's going on Instagram? Like I would go back to one of the ones and think that I had, and then I would, and I would go through them over and over and over.
It
was, those are the worst kind of like cycles to be in.
Yeah. It's, I've been there. It's crazy. Like I remember back in the day, back when Facebook wasn't fucking horrible. I remember I would be on Facebook for like an hour and then I'd open a new tab in my browser and like instinctively type in Facebook. And I was just like, this is really fucked
what
up.
Am I doing? Yeah, it's fucked up.
And, but it's, you know, part of the, you know, like the first thing I always recommend is I say like, you know, however many people you follow, like set a goal, like unfollow it, like 80% of the people you follow, like just start.
Why is that a good thing to do?
So it's just, first of all, it's a loose play on like the 80-20 rule, which is this idea that like 80% of the value that you're probably getting from social media, it's probably from only like 20% of the people you follow. Like all the junk and bullshit and distractions are probably coming from everything else. So it's like really like limit yourself to following only people either you really, really care about or really, really respect. Or who like make you feel good or make you happy or whatever. But the beauty of that is like, once you like pare down how many people you follow, you what you find is you can't do that cycle you were just talking about. So like the reason you can do that cycle you were just talking about is like, if you go 20 minutes without checking Twitter, but you follow like 800 people, 20 minutes, there's a whole new batch of content to go look at. But if you only follow like, you know, 20 people or 40 people, 20 minutes isn't enough for there. You go back to Twitter and there's only one new tweet and you're like, okay, well, I guess it's time to close Twitter until tomorrow. Cause that's
kinda
when there's
do something else.
So it's like, you kind of just, it's to go back to the food analogy. It's like limiting the portions on your plate. Like, you know, obviously if somebody puts a plate with like 8,000 calories in front of you, you're definitely going to eat a lot. Whereas if they put a plate with, you know, say 800 calories in front of you, then you have a much better chance of being like having a healthy portion.
Dude, I love that analogy. And one last thing I wanted to ask you, because I'm assuming because it's out there, we can talk about the fact that you're writing with Will Smith.
Yep. Yeah.
Tell us a secret. What's his penis look like? Like, tell us something you don't know.
Oh man. Dude, you just like I you like I mean, scramble you scramble my brain with that one. Like
it's
like how do I follow that up?
It's like it's so cool because he is, you know, he's such an iconic guy. And I think about, you know, man, for the field of entertainment to have done what he's done
like
over the course of decades now and reinvent himself and just, I mean, hit the levels of the success that he has. And like, even in the last year, he started doing more, you know, like vlog stuff. I mean, like, you know, YouTube, and you go like, even that stuff, just knocking it out of the park. Just like, I just find him to be an endlessly fascinating, inspiring, you know, entertaining dude. And like, I'm excited that you guys are paired up.
Yeah. So yeah, his team reached out, he's wanted to write a book for a while. And his team reached out and I met up with him, I think 2018, hung out with him for a weekend, you know, and kind of going into it, like I never really like aspired to like write co-author like celebrity memoirs or whatever.
Yeah.
But you know, he's Will Smith, so like you take the media. But like when I went in to meet him, you know, I kind of had two conditions in mind to take on the project. The first one was he can't be an asshole. Like, he's got to be a good, like, I'm just not going to work with an asshole, period. And then two was, I felt like he really needed to like want the book for the right reasons. Like, it can't just be like another trophy for his mantle or like a PR strategy or whatever. And so when I met him, like, he's the sweetest dude. Like, honestly, he's so much cooler than he has to be. I saw him. It was funny. The first time I hung out with him, I watched him like walk through a hotel lobby and just get mobbed by people. And I was watching him and I'm like, man, he's nicer to his fans than I am. Like, and he's fucking Will Smith. He gets like bombarded every day for the last 30 years. And I'm like, wow, I should be better to my fans. I found him personally very inspiring as a professional of like, this is how you, you know, this is how you deal with an audience. This is how you deal with your team. This is how you collaborate. I really, really look up to him in those ways. But, you know, when I sat down with him and I was like, you know, why do you want to do this? He basically told me, he said, look, like, being an A-list celeb, especially in the 90s and early 2000s, like, you're constantly hiding yourself from the world. You're like running away from paparazzi and you're like, you know, you've got all this fucked up stuff being written about you in tabloids and stuff. And he's like, so you're constantly like putting distance between yourself and the world. And he said, like, the world's changed and I can like control my relationship with people now. And he said, I want people to know who I really am and how I really am. And I want them to know my life, the things I've been through. Like, people, I mean, he's been through a lot of shit. Like, and he's never shared that before. So I was like, fuck yeah, dude, that's awesome. I'm on, if that's the goal here, you know, kind of that vulnerability piece that we were talking about, like,
sure,
I'm in. And it was a blast. And, I wish I could give you like some like nitty gritty dirt or whatever, but like, it's just fucking cool, dude. Like, it's just,
I believe it, man. Was your process like, you have to talk a lot, you have to hang out a lot, right? Or you guys just like spoke a lot and.
Yeah. I mean, I came into it just being a very kind of casual Will Smith fan. I didn't really know a whole lot about him. And so, I told him, I was like, well, you know, step one is I basically need to like download your life into my brain. And so I traveled with him on and off for about a year. I met all of his family, bunch of his friends, childhood friends, hung out with Jazzy Jeff, like met, Alfonso Ribeiro from Fresh Prince. Like it just like crazy shit. And just like collected all these details and stuff from his life. I mean, the thing I would say about him that I think people don't realize is, he has this unbelievable gift of just charisma and kind of making things look effortless. He is maybe like the most resilient individual I've ever met in my life. You know, one of my first conversations with him, he was telling me about his childhood and he was like, yeah, when I was 9 years old, I saw my dad beat my mom to the point that she started coughing up blood. And he said, and I was like, how did you respond to that? And he said, I immediately knew that I needed to be the adult in the house. And I was like, Jesus Christ, man. And he was like, I was. And he said, I knew one day I was going to have to take care of everybody. And so, and he was like, and by 18, I had a hit record and I did. And I was like, fuck, man. Like, you know, 99% of people would not react that way, much less actually go do it. So I'm like, all right, dude, I'll write your fucking book. Let's do this.
Well, I can't wait to read that one too, man. And dude, I really enjoyed this chat with you, man. Thank you so much for
absolutely,
dude. Jumping on. Yeah,
absolutely.
Hopefully we can meet up sometime, maybe down here at ATX or I don't know, somewhere else, but it'll be fun.
Absolutely.